Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Supreme Court when we come back. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor. We've been taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if a plumber said, he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? Or what if a carpenter said, he who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client? Now, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or his own steps is incompetent? Well, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who can't represent himself in court has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or that carpenter. Now, listen to James Nielsen. Now, Nielsen is a professor at the Hastings Law School. Here's what he said. He said, quote, it is a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. And he said it's worse than that. Most students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real, honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. And a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. And a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for those students and for their clients, that it is a cruel hoax. That's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. While you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free. That number again, 417-273-4967. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure, our school is available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Just click on the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget. All right, we've been talking about the Supreme Court. It's put out, this particular article is put out by the Foundations of Liberty up in East Moline, Illinois. I'm going to give you their name and address here. That's the guy's name is James R. Patrick. The title of the article is The Supreme Court. It's put out by Foundations of Liberty, 946th Avenue, East Moline, Illinois, 61244. So once more, that's Foundations of Liberty, 946th Avenue in East Moline, M-O-L-I-N-E, Illinois, 61244. The editor is James R. Patrick. They got a phone up there, too. The number is 309-796-1485. Once more, that's area code 309, the number 796-1485. Now, the Supreme Court of the United States is the final authority on law. If you like it or lump it, that's the way the game is played here in this country, and probably in your country if you're in an Anglo-Saxon administration around the world. And these courts, this appellate process, dates back to and has a long history that starts with Moses at Mount Sinai. And what we have today is a changed judiciary. And we call judges judges instead of priests. And they're still ruling on laws and giving us judgments, which is what the intent and purpose of the whole process was. When you go back to Deuteronomy chapter 1, Moses instructed the judges to rule with righteous judgment, and that they were to rule based upon this law. Blackstone's commentaries points to, with unmistaking direct citations and quotations from the Bible, the origin of Anglo-Saxon administration, the common law of England, dates to Moses at Mount Sinai, the Ten Commandments. That's why I call it the Ten Commandment model versus the Ten Planks to the Communist Manifesto model. Now, here in America, there's been some criticism of the Supreme Court and its rulings, and that's what we're talking about now, is the runaway court, the change that has occurred in our Supreme Court over the past, since the 1930s. There has been a very profound shift in our thinking toward our Constitution, toward our courts, our judicial system, and the law of the land. So in the article, the easiest place to destroy the Constitution is in the United States Supreme Court. And unfortunately, America has had few occasions to recall this elementary truth, and yet today there's a great need to remember it. A long roll call of recent Supreme Court opinions threatened to drastically alter the shape of American government. Our vulnerability through the court needs the understanding of every thoughtful citizen if it is to be overcome. The Achilles heel of our constitutional republic was not created by the Constitution itself. The first of this series of editorials demonstrated that the court's original grant of power was not at all what it is now generally conceived to be. Except for a picayunish list of matters over which it has original jurisdiction under the Constitution, the court is entirely dependent upon the will of Congress for the breadth of its authority over appeals from lower courts. None of the court's recent law-making opinions, which will be discussed specifically in later editorials, falls within the area of the court's original jurisdiction. And the cases went before the court not because they had to go there, but because Congress had not exercised its right to prohibit them from going there. Had the Congress done so, the decisions of the lower federal courts would now be what is so glibly and erroneously called the law of the land, and most of the lower court decisions were the exact opposite of the later Supreme Court ruling. The irony of it is that the dominant position of the Supreme Court over national life has been established by the kind of stratified tradition at which majority members of the present court aim their sharpest jibes. Chief Justice John Marshall, during his 34 years on the Supreme Court bench beginning in 1801, inaugurated the idea that the Supreme Court is the last word on what is and is not constitutional. Marshall's innovation was accepted not because the Constitution required it, but because it provided a seemingly reasonable guide for judicial action. The potential danger of the Marshall Doctrine was foreseen early in the nation's history by some famous patriots. Thomas Jefferson worried over the fate of the Constitution that he had helped to shape, and he said, "It's a very dangerous doctrine to consider the judges, the ultimate arbiters of all constitutional questions." The Constitution was erected, or has erected, no such tribunal. And for many dormant years, Jefferson's warning seemed to be an extremist view. With few notable exceptions, the same body of tradition which supported its expanded power constrained the Supreme Court to honor the Constitution. Up until our own time, the court, as a general rule, exercised its extra-constitutional authority in support of the Constitution. But then came what Ralph Gabriel, in his thoughtful book called The Course of American Democratic Thought, calls legal realism. The realists, wrote Gabriel, looked upon written constitutions and the positive laws that issued from the legislatures as instruments of social engineering. The public is more familiar with this philosophy when it's expressed in another way. The Constitution, say these realists, is a document which must be constantly revised in keeping with the times. And this argument has enough of a ring of logic to it to be popular. But the realists are reformers who are in a hurry. They close their eyes to the process of amendment provided for in the Constitution. They prefer to make the Constitution what they think that it should be by judicial interpretation. They, above all others, argue that the law is what the court says it is. Because if they can make that claim stick, the sociological and political future of the nation is at the mercy of the majority of the legal realists who now occupy the Supreme Court bench. Now, there is ample evidence that the present Supreme Court has twisted the Constitution and the law into weird shapes to further the individual social philosophies of some justices. The danger foreseen by Jefferson as a result of Supreme Court assumption of a power that has not been delegated to it has materialized in a socio-political philosophy which holds that the Constitution is an instrument to be used by the court, and not the court an instrument to serve the Constitution. Now, for the future of their nation, Americans must insist that it is the Constitution which is the supreme law over the court, not the court being the supreme law over the Constitution. Okay, this is called The Runaway Courts from Foundations of Liberty. Remember, it's put out by the East Moline Christian School. James R. Patrick is the editor, 946th Avenue, East Moline, Illinois. 61244 is the zip code. Their phone up there is 309-796-1485. All right, I'll give you that name and number as we progress along here once or twice more. Let's take a look at another editorial. This editorial now comes from the Indianapolis Star, written back in the 1950s when the activist war in the court was at its peak, making decisions. Now, there's two schools of thought here. Remember, Jefferson's school of thought. He was one of the original founding fathers. He said the Supreme Court does not have the power to interpret the constitutionality of the Constitution. That remains with the Congress, with the President, and with the court. Each one of these three branches independently does that of and by and for itself. But John Marshall, now the second Supreme Court Chief Justice, said, no, that's nonsense, that what we need here is the court to determine what is constitutional for the other two branches of government. Now, that was actually played out in 1834, 35, 36. When Andrew Jackson was president, two court decisions came down in favor of the Cherokee Indian Nation. And President Jackson ignored the court's ruling and threw the Indians off their land anyway. Now, there's an example of the president then exercising his discretion, his determination as to what the Constitution means insofar as the executive power is concerned. Now, in the 1930s, the president sought, as President Roosevelt, sought to pack the court. And the court struck it down and said, no, that's unconstitutional. Now, do we need a Supreme Court as a check and balance on the other two branches of government, or do the three branches of government determine for themselves what the Constitution is, or in short, what the law is? Now, since 1800, at least, it has been the other way around, and Marshall's doctrine has been followed, and that's what we're all used to. The reason I'm bringing this to your attention is that there is another school of thought out there, and whether or not you agree with it, that's your choice in life. I'm just a reporter. I'm going to report to you as a second choice here. Now, the United States Supreme Court under Chief Justice Earl Warren is engaged in amending the 10th article of the Bill of Rights. On the books, this article still says, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states, respectively, or to the people, whether it's the intention of the Warren Court to stop at judicial amendment or eventually to repeal that provision entirely without bothering with constitutional process still remains to be seen. Now, at Appomattox Courthouse, this is an editorial opinion on my part, now at Appomattox Courthouse in 1865, this question of states' rights was settled. Settled right there at the end of the Civil War. And the United States of America is supreme over the states. Not because that's what the Constitution calls for. The 10th Amendment to the Constitution says no, that's not true. In 1805 and in 1830-something, two states had talked about seceding from the Union. Nobody argued that they didn't have the right to secede from the Union. But when 11 states decided to secede, and when those 11 states, with their combined taxing power, furnished more than 50% of the federal government's budget from those 11 rich southern states, the North said, no, you can't go. Now, that was a political decision which was settled by war. It wasn't settled by the Constitution, settled by war. The Reconstruction amendments that I mentioned to you earlier, the Supreme Court of Utah really came down on that 14th Amendment when they said the Congress of the United States and the U.S. Supreme Court can, in fact, overturn our opinions and decisions, but that's not the intent of the Constitution. It ought not to be that way. Now, that's just one more state, you know, just one state out of 50. And said, hey, wait a minute, the federal government, and particularly the Supreme Court, is usurping the powers of the state, which are reserved to the states, and to their legislatures and to their laws. Now, I noticed out in California on this gay rights vote, the Supreme Court out there said the will of the people is superior. So the California Supreme Court bowed to that 10th Amendment to the Constitution and said the powers are reserved to the people, and the people said gay marriage is wrong, they didn't want. So they voted in a constitutional amendment. Now, that being the case, that is the correct way for the people of the state to make a determination as to what law they want to follow. If that's the case in California today, why wasn't that the case with the Mormons in Utah in the 1870s when they wanted polygamy? See? So when the Mormons wanted polygamy, the federal government came along and said, no, not in our country. So if you're an anti-polygamist, that's the way we want this to work. It can't be that a group of people called Mormons can go out to Utah and practice their religious life their way. The other states get involved in it and say, no, we're not going to allow that. And that's what you have to this day, that the national consensus is determined from Washington, D.C., and the rest of the country will bow to it. As examples, Nevada and Wyoming wanted speed limits, something higher than 55 miles an hour in Washington, and the Department of Transportation said, you do that, and we'll take all of your highway trust fund money from you, which is coercion because those states depend upon federal money to build those highways. There's not very many people in Wyoming. There's not enough people in Wyoming to tax themselves to build a freeway from one side of the state to the other. And that's the kind of coercion that is applied from Washington, D.C. Now, whether that's good or bad, I'll leave it for you to decide. Going on, he says, a score of opinions by the court in the last 2 years support the conclusion that repeal by ossification is the final goal. Having adopted the peculiar philosophy that the Supreme Court has somehow divinely chosen to keep the Constitution in tune with the times, even at the cost of ignoring it, the court has managed to make law, which is not a judicial prerogative, in direct opposition to the 10th Amendment. Now, examples in proof of the court's duplicity are so outstanding that they cry for the attention of every citizen who might be concerned for the welfare of his government, as he has known it in the past, or as he might want his children to know it in the future. Because these are decisions which strike at the very heart of an American's right to a voice in his own community affairs on a community level. Now, let's take a look at a case called Pennsylvania versus Steve Nelson. Pennsylvania. Again, it's called Pennsylvania versus Steve Nelson. Was such a decision. Now, Nelson is an admitted communist leader who was tried and convicted in Pennsylvania courts under a Pennsylvania anti-sedition law. Now, despite the provisions of Article 4, Section 2 of the Constitution, which recognizes a state's right to prosecute for treason, the Supreme Court threw the case out. Why? Well, because it said the federal government had preempted the sedition field by passing the Smith Act. As a result, the anti-sedition laws of 42 states and of Alaska and Hawaii were made unenforceable. Now here again, here's the 10th Amendment, which says these powers are reserved to the states and to the people, respectively. The Supreme Court comes down and says, no, Congress passed a statute called the Smith Act, and that supersedes the Constitution of Pennsylvania. Now that's the way we do things in this country. And Thomas Jefferson said, no, that's not correct. It ought not to be that way. And so I'm leaving it for you to decide. Now, here's another one called Schwer versus Board of Bar Examiners of New Mexico, where it says it provided two decisions of a kind. In both cases, the United States Supreme Court overruled state Supreme Courts and state bar examiners. It said, in effect, that the states cannot be permitted to determine that communist or communist front activities reflect on the moral character of an applicant for a license to practice as an attorney. It might as well have said that no state can require good moral character of the men who, upon being admitted to practice in state courts, become in fact officers of those same state courts. Now, there's nothing in the Constitution to justify this invasion of rights which historically have belonged to the states. Another example is Schlauer versus Board of Education of New York, where the Supreme Court covered three state courts, or reversed rather, three state courts, and nullified an entirely reasonable state law which provided for the discharge of subversive teachers or those who refused to discuss subversive connections. The Supreme Court itself subsequently admitted that it was in error about the facts of the case, but nevertheless refused to alter its erroneous opinion. In Sweezy versus New Hampshire, the Supreme Court ruled that the highest law enforcement officer of the state, the Attorney General, did not even have the right to question a college professor about subversive activities, and where the Nelson case led off by denying the right to states to prosecute for attempts to overthrow the government, and that means state governments as well as federal, the Sweezy case followed up by prohibiting the states from even investigating such alleged treason. Now, as if to prove that the Sweezy opinion was not an accidental result of something the justices ate, it was reinforced by a companion opinion in Raleigh, Stern and Brown versus Ohio. Here, the Warren Court held that the state had no right at all to punish for contemptuous refusal to answer state legislature's questions about subversion. And of course, all of these Supreme Court opinions were of considerable comfort to Marxist communism, which by Supreme Court decision is a conspiracy for the treasonable overthrow of the American government. But above and beyond the issue of communism, the opinions themselves subverted the Constitution by substituting the personal philosophies of the majority justices for the rule of law, which has withstood all challenges for almost 200 years. The danger of communism is grave enough, but it may be that a graver danger yet exists in a court which attempts to use one phrase in the Constitution to amend the rest of it, and then ends by concluding that there is no Constitution at all except that which the court writes. All right, so there's three or four cases. Now, all those cases deal with communism and subversion and so on. And you might say, well, you know, I'm a civil libertarian. What it tends to boil down to is if you're in favor of a particular decision, well, then it's good for the Supreme Court to make it. If you're opposed to it, well, then it's bad that the Supreme Court made that decision and that power ought to be taken away from it. You know, it kind of depends on where you sit. Now, if in fact Jefferson's view was correct, then I might ask the question also, well, what about the rights of the Cherokee Indians? When President Jackson took it upon himself to interpret the Constitution the way he wanted to, he sent the army out and threw those people off their land. Now, the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. Those people own that land. It's their property rights, and they've got a right to it. Now, the Supreme Court does not have an army with which to enforce its rules. In the school integration cases back in the 1950s, in Little Rock, Arkansas, as an illustration, there was a governor down there, and he said, well, we here in Arkansas are opposed to integration of our public schools. And I think at the time, the majority of the people of Arkansas would have agreed with that. And so a court had ordered, I think it was the Supreme Court of the United States, had ordered that the Little Rock Central High School be integrated. And then, of course, the governor sent out the highway patrol. And here were standing on the steps of the school, a bunch of policemen, and I think it was, I don't know, six, seven marshals escorting these students to school. And the marshals, you know, they took a look at the numbers, and they said, well, I guess we're not going to integrate this school today. I don't know how many highway patrol officers are there, but probably 20, 30, 50, maybe, I don't know. And so 50 to 5 sounded like to the marshals they ought to retreat, and so they did. And so the issue went to the President of the United States, and his name was Dwight D. Eisenhower at the time, and President Eisenhower then got on the horn, and he called up the, I think it was the 101st Airborne. And so they sent a division of U.S. Army troops to Little Rock, Arkansas. And so now the balance of power shifted again, you know, from
50 policemen against five marshals to now there's, you know, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 soldiers against 50 policemen. Now, had the governor decided to escalate, I suppose he could have called out the National Guard. And you'd have the whole state National Guard of Arkansas up against one division. I don't know how that would have come out, but, you know, just in theory here. Well, then what would we do? Call up the Marines and call up the Coast Guard and maybe the Air Force. Maybe we need nuclear weapons. I don't know what would be the next step in the escalation. But anyway, when the Army got there, well, then the state backed down and said, well, I guess that's the way it's going to be. Now, again, there's a choice to be made in California. The California Supreme Court said, well, the will of the people to amend the Constitution is the way to do that. So can states, could some states have segregation and other states not? Well, Washington says, no, you can't. Every state is going to follow the 14th Amendment. The time was when, if you didn't like it, well, then you could lump it. And the state was superior. This is in the era of states' rights. Now, when they talk about states' rights, we're not talking about states' rights. States don't have any rights. That's the bottom line. And I said before, that was settled at Appomattox Courthouse. All right, with that in mind, let's pause right here and let me remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective, not state schools and all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. Has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or this local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about Foundations of Liberty. Remember, the Foundations of Liberty is located at 900. I'll give you that address again, 900 46th Avenue in East Moline, Illinois, 61244. If you'd like a copy of the article that we are reviewing, it's entitled The Supreme Court Put Out by the Foundations of Liberty at the East Moline Christian School, 946th Avenue, East Moline, Illinois. Foundations of Liberty is published bimonthly by the East Moline Christian School. The East Moline Christian School believes and teaches the fundamental truths of the Bible, as well as offering a total academic program for grades K through 12. We firmly believe in the principles that gave birth to America. Therefore, we teach without apology the concepts of biblical law, limited constitutional government, the right of private property, and the free market system. The cost of this publication is met through donations. Donations are encouraged and appreciated in any amount. May we suggest $25 a year per person on the mailing list. Sample copies of the Foundations of Liberty are available to any interested person in the United States upon request. If you're outside the United States and you're interested in a copy of this, then what I would suggest is that you send them a $5 bill or in your currency, whatever it is, and to cover the cost of handling and postage and see if they'll send you a copy to Great Britain or Australia or anyplace else in the world. It's a good publication. It's not just a U.S. publication, but the principles involved will cover you in your country around the world. All right, now this thing called the runaway court. What kind of government does the United States Supreme Court think should rule over America? That's a question being asked. What kind of government does the United States Supreme Court think should rule over the country? What's their view of government? Well, a decade ago, the question would have been meaningless. Today, its answer is of vital importance because the court is reshaping the form of our government with a speed which, unless checked, will leave little that is recognizable for another generation, bolstered by the glib falsehood that the law is what the court says it is, alibied by the materialist assumption that the precise principles of the Constitution exist only through judicial interpretation. The Warren Court already has decreed changes so stunning that a normal person's first reaction must be, I'm imagining things. Now, the Supreme Court's attack has not been on states' rights alone. The federal administrative authority came under Supreme Court fire in one of the most amazing rulings ever handed down. In the case of John Stewart, the court held that the Secretary of State could not discharge his own employee for security reasons because another group of the Secretary's employees, comprising his loyalty review board, had previously failed to recommend discharge. The ruling was made in the face of an act of Congress empowering the Secretary to fire any employee within the sole discretion without regard to hearings or other administrative procedure. Now, these are cases that deal with subversion, communism, and loyalty to the United States. And whether or not these are the proper bailiwick of the Supreme Court is, you know, another question, but I'm pointing this out and giving you the option here to see that there's another side to this concept of the Supreme Court making law here in the United States, and this concept of the Supreme Court making law by judicial interpretation. So you've probably heard that term. That's law being made by the Supreme Court, and this is what they're complaining about. Federal law enforcement procedure was temporarily disrupted by the famous ruling ordering Federal Bureau of Investigation files thrown open to criminal defendants, specifically a suspected communist, Clinton E. Jenks, J-E-N-C-K-S. As a result of the decision, President Eisenhower privately expressed something less than pleasure with at least one of his own appointees to the Supreme Court. At the urging of the U.S. Justice Department, Congress hastened to undo some of the damage with a law which partly nullified the court's opinion. But for an all-inclusive demonstration of illegal judicial lawmaking founded upon error and ending in a blatant attempt to put into the Constitution something which is not there. The Watkins case has few equals. The court ruled in this case that the House Committee on Un-American Activities had no right to require John T. Watkins to answer questions about his former associates in the Communist Party. And the reason, said the court, was that the committee had not told Watkins what specific law his testimony might help to write. The law the court virtually created, which can nowhere be found in either Constitution or federal statutes, is that congressional committees cannot conduct investigations unless they know in advance what legislation the investigations will show to be necessary. As a practical matter, the opinion put an almost immediate halt to effective congressional investigation of communism in the United States. But just as the decision on FBI files was immediately seized upon by drug peddlers and other common criminals to gain freedom, so the Watkins decisions will apply to virtually all fields of congressional investigation. The Watkins decision, which reads as much like a piece of political oratory against red debaters as it does like a Supreme Court opinion, was notable for its factual errors as well as its weird conclusions. The opinion, for example, recommended that congressional committees adopt the tactics of Canadian Royal Commissions of Inquiry because of their success in fulfilling their fact-finding missions without resort to coercive tactics. The fact is that royal commissions may arrest witnesses, hold them incommunicado for many days, conduct questioning in secret, punish witnesses for failure to answer any questions, and do not recognize any immunity such as the Fifth Amendment provides. A congressional committee can do none of these things. Now, another almost childish error or fact is the court's statement that congressional investigations, such as those of the Committee on Un-American Activities, were of a new kind, which had developed in the decade following World War II. Now, the fact is that congressional investigation into communist subversion were in full swing in 1919, and the Committee on Un-American Activities itself was founded in 1938. Neither the court-made law in Watkins nor factual error in arriving at it strikes as dangerously at the American heritage as the clear attempt in the same opinion to amend the Constitution by unconstitutional means. The opinion, which was written by Chief Justice Warren, says, nor can the First Amendment's freedoms of speech, press, religion, or political belief or association be abridged. The First Amendment does guarantee freedom of speech, press, religion, and assembly. But what are these supposed freedoms of political belief and association which Warren has added? Is freedom of political belief the right to assassinate a government? Is freedom of association the right to associate in a criminal conspiracy? One can only guess what the Supreme Court would hold once this court-made amendment has solidified into accepted law. The kind of government the court appears to want is a government by jurists acting without restraint by written statute, and it is not the kind of government under which America can survive in freedom for much longer. Now, I have pointed out a time or two that we have an option here. We have the Ten Commandment model, and we have the Ten Planks to the Communist Manifesto model. Today in America, we practice all 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. It's not something that was brought about by the Supreme Court of and by itself, but it has certainly been aided and abetted by the court. And I don't think anybody could deny that. Now, whether the individual departments, and here again, if in fact Jefferson was correct, and that Congress has the power to rein in the court, then why doesn't Congress do that? Do the members of Congress know that they have the power to rein in the court? I'm just asking the question. I just wanted to throw it out there for you to consider. You know. Now, as a general rule, we'd have to ask the question conversely, well, what would we do with Nixon and Watergate if we didn't have the court? What would we do with Bush and waterboarding or Guantanamo or? Congress has enacted the Patriot Act, 1,300 pages of the most obscene communist diatribe that I've ever witnessed in my lifetime, and the members of Congress admitted that they never read it before they voted on it. Now, that doesn't seem to me to be a problem with the Supreme Court. It seems to me to be a problem with Congress. Now, once that abortion has been incorporated into a law, and now if a question comes up to the Supreme Court concerning the Patriot Act, how is the Supreme Court supposed to react? Are they supposed to sit back and say, well, gee, Congress passed it, so Congress can make the determination as to whether it's constitutional? Somehow, that just, to me, doesn't ring as being a matter of common sense. And then the president over here, you know, when President Bush said he wasn't going to follow the laws of Congress, he wrote exceptions into the law. Let me ask you this. If Congress enacts a law and the president says, I won't enforce it, now what do you do? You know, these are questions, you know, that have to be asked and answered. Marshall's conclusion was that the court would then construe the Constitution and the powers that were required and consented under that Constitution. And, you know, in 1834 or 5, when this question came up with the Cherokee Indians, the President of the United States said, you know, here's one for you, and we're not going to follow the Supreme Court. And the court doesn't have an army with which to enforce its orders, but the president does. Talk about checks and balances now. You know, who checks the president's power? Does Congress and the Supreme Court, do they have enough power to check the president? Let's take a look here at the runaway court, number 5. Too much of the law of our land is being rewritten today by sociological authors with one eye on some personal ideology and the other on book publication royalties. They hold no governmental office, elective or appointed. They're under no oath to support the Constitution, and yet the justices of the United States Supreme Court have shown a disturbing tendency to regard their opinions above both Constitution and legislative law. Justice William O. Douglas, writing the court's opinion upholding constitutionality of compulsory unionism in railroad operations, said, one would have to be blind to history to assert that trade unionism did not enhance and strengthen the right to work. See Webb, History of Trade Unionism, Gregory, Labor and Labor Law. One of the books that he cited as an authority was written in the 1890s. Now, Chief Justice Earl Warren, in the historic school desegregation case, wrote, whatever may have been the extent of psychological knowledge at the time of Plessy v. Ferguson, this new finding is amply supported by modern authority in reversing the 58-year-old Supreme Court doctrine in favor of separation or separate but equal school facilities as it had been enunciated in the Plessy case. Warren went on to cite 6 supposed authorities and then added, and see generally, Myrdal, An American Dilemma. Now, to keep the record straight, we repeat what we have shown so many times, that we bitterly oppose public school segregation. But we would be false to our principles if we did not recognize that the new reliance of the Supreme Court on sociology instead of law makes a mockery of law. The Swedish sociologist Gunnar Myrdal, in the very same book, which is given all-inclusive acceptance by the Warren opinion, writes that the Constitution of the United States is impractical and unsuited to modern conditions, and that its adoption was nearly a plot against the common people. Now, sociology, while still an infant science and subject to all the errors of infancy, nevertheless is entitled to thoughtful consideration when laws are made. If the Constitution is to be amended, the advice of social scientists should be given as much weight as the people think wise. But the place for sociology is in the making of laws, not in their judicial administration. Sociologists should be heard when an amendment to the Constitution is considered by Congress and the states, not when someone proposes an illegal amendment through the back door by way of a court decision. And the court is, in fact, exceeding its own powers under the Constitution when it attempts to say that a law which meant one thing yesterday must mean something else today because the times have changed. The process of legislative action and constitutional amendment were specifically designed to meet changing times. The Supreme Court is not assigned any part in these processes. The court has no right to pass upon the wisdom of any law. It has the right, and this only by consent of Congress, to pass upon a law's constitutionality. And the Constitution, in its highest sense, is a set of moral principles laid down for the guidance of the nation. It has, for several years, been under indirect attack by political and juridical pragmatists who profess to believe that it can be kept alive only by being changed from day to day in keeping with the will of the majority or the findings of sociology. Essentially, they propose a government of expedience administered by judicial authority. And the eventual outcome of their program could be nothing but a kind of disorderly society in which no one knew from hour to hour what the law might be. Now, unfortunately, the Supreme Court has gone a long way toward adopting the theory that the Constitution has no validity except that the court and its authorities permit it to have. It has sought to give the writings of obscure authors greater power in the lawmaking process than Congress has. And it has relied more upon sociologists than upon lawyers for its references. If justice under the law is to remain the American creed, then this trend must be halted and reversed. All right, let me give you the name of the author here again. We're talking about the Supreme Court from the publication called Foundations of Liberty, put out by the editor James R. Patrick. From the East Moline Christian School, located at 946th Avenue, East Moline, Illinois, 61244. Their phone up there is 309-796-1485. Once again, the phone number 309-796-1485. East Moline Christian School. You people up in Chicago might want to inquire as to the availability of space to educate your children. The public school system here in the United States is objectionable to many of us. It's objectionable to me. And I think it sucks. And about 3% of Americans agree with me. 3% of American school children are now in homeschool. 97% of American children are in public school or parochial school. I don't know how many people are enrolled in the parochial school system in the country. I haven't seen a number on that recently, but 3%, I just saw on USA Today, are now being educated by their parents. Can you believe that? And so if you're dissatisfied with public school, why don't you think about parochial school or homeschool? And maybe we could educate your children, not that we're going to educate the nation, but maybe you could educate your children to a new concept of life, the Ten Commandment model, as opposed to the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. And I might point out that the 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto calls for a free education for all children in public school. So it makes all the sense in the world for the government, a communist government, to educate children in the public school system because it promotes the interests of communism. So if you're sending your children to public school to educate them to the values of the Constitution or to moral values, isn't that an oxymoron? Excuse me. Second plank to the Communist Manifesto calls for a heavy progressive income tax. Our Constitution calls for the financing of a limited federal government by imposts and exposts. Just thought I'd throw that out there for your consideration. Now, Americans, I guess, have decided that financing their government by income tax is the way they want to go. But if that's the case, then why are we practicing the second plank to the Communist Manifesto and then denouncing communism at the same time? Isn't that an oxymoron? And then we've got the central bank. You know, the fifth plank calls for the establishment of a central bank that produces our currency. Our Constitution provides for gold and silver coin at Article 1, Section 10. So evidently, Americans have accepted the income tax plank 2, public school plank 10, central bank plank 5, and send their children to public school to educate their children to what? Morality and constitutional values? Come on, let's wake up and smell the coffee. You can't have it both ways. I mean, you can't have free sex in a whorehouse with virgins. That is an oxymoron. There aren't any virgins in a whorehouse, boys. Let's wake up and smell the coffee here. Talking about the runaway court, the United States Supreme Court needs curbing. It has leaped the boundaries of constitutionality and replaced the rule by law with rule by the court, usurped or shriveled the rightful functions of legislative and executive departments, and it has attempted to make of the states mere puppets to sociology. The justices have refused respect to their own predecessors and ignored the competence of better men in the lower courts. Action to offset this assault upon the balance of American government is imperative. Remedies that have been suggested range all the way down from the extreme of impeachment. More moderate are measures introduced in Congress where the final responsibility is placed by the Constitution. The heart of the problem is how to preserve the Supreme Court, not how to punish it or humble it. The goal that must be sought was expressed by Chief Justice John Marshall many years ago. He wrote that the Constitution is neither a superior or paramount law unchangeable by ordinary means, or is it the level with or on the level with ordinary legislative acts. It is alterable when the legislature shall please to alter it. If the former part of the alternative be true, then a legislative act contrary to the Constitution is not the law. If the latter part be true, then written constitutions are absurd attempts on the part of the people to limit the power of government in its own nature, illimitable. Substitute court decrees for legislative acts and the court for the legislature, and Marshall's doctrine is still valid. Let's think about it for a minute. There's a process written into the Constitution to keep it abreast of the times. If we come to the conclusion that the Plessy separate but equal doctrine is no longer workable, instead of the Supreme Court integrating the schools, you go to the Constitution and you amend the Constitution to include integration. And then you've changed the law to meet the times, as opposed to changing the meaning of the Constitution without amending it. So I would concur with Jefferson on that point, that the court has gotten out of control by using sociology and unelected people and their opinions and doctrines to legislate in place of the legislature. It may be, if you're a pro-integration person, that you approve of the Supreme Court's modality. But if that's the case, well, then the Supreme Court has the power then to change the law without amendment, and you may not agree with it the next time. You ever stop to think about that? When government gets so big that it can give you everything that you want, that's a government that's big enough to take everything that you've got. And that's why limited government was the rule in this country until 1933. Hey, I'm running out of time. Let me give you a final reminder that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the internet radio. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk, and The Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.